The title of the message is The Garden of Eden. I'm not going to read as much as what is listed because I'm not going to get that far. So I'm going to read 9, 8, 9, and that's it. Now the Lord had planted a garden in the east in Eden, and there he put the man he had formed. The Lord God made all kinds of trees to grow out of the ground, trees that were pleasing to the eye and good for food. In the middle of the garden there was the tree of life and the tree of knowledge of good and evil. I had the privilege last night, Colleen and I, to watch an old movie called To Kill a Mockingbird. I was impressed again, or reminded again, that life is complicated and that doing what is right is not always easy and clear. It's a wonderful movie, and it depicts a lot of themes. There is a place called, in Colorado Springs, called the Garden of the Gods. It's a public park, and as I said, it's located in Colorado Springs in Colorado, and it is designated, was designated as a national natural landmark in 1971. And it was first called the Red Rock Corral by the Europeans. Then in August about 1859, two surveyors who were helping to set up the city of Colorado Springs, they were surveyors, one was M.S. Beach, suggested that it was a place for a great beer garden. And his companion, a young Rufus Cable, awestruck by the impressive rock formations, said, "Beer garden? Why, it's a fit place for the gods to assemble, and we will call it the Garden of the Gods." And it is a massive rock formations of various different kinds. I've never visited it. I saw a couple pictures of it. It looks like a very beautiful place. Many of, over the years, have planted a garden. I, myself, have planted gardens over many years, different kinds. Some yield much, and sometimes they were just a plain downright flop. So it wasn't always a good thing. Sometimes the weather had to do with it. Other things had to do with it. But the question I always wondered is, was God in control of it? The question I asked this morning. Or who is in charge of the weather? Who determines whether or not my garden does good or not? I always wondered about that each year as I plant it. But there are many things in life that are rewarding in my life, but one of them has always been a great harvest at the end of the year when you harvest out of a garden. Dare I say, God the many planted a garden with a harvest in mind in this story, and that is us in our hearts and minds. The garden theme goes the whole way through the Bible, and I'm not going to go there yet. I'm going to wait till later on in the text to go there. But it's a theme: Gethsemane, Resurrection Garden, the new heaven and new earth. And Isaiah uses it many times as an illustration of what is going to come in a better time. John Milton wrote Paradise Lost and Paradise Restored, a great book or a literary writing. And it talks about how we were kicked out of the garden and we eventually want to be restored. It's a thick reading. I never read it the whole way through, but I read parts of it. So the idea of a garden theme is carried all the way through the Bible. I want to start looking at the text itself. And I want to remind us that whoever the compiler was of these texts, of these early stories, before we get up to the actual history of the Israelite people, I'm not really sure who wrote it, who compiled it, but I do think that whoever did had many themes in mind. They wanted to illustrate some ideas and illustrate some to make us think. I don't know if Moses wrote it or... You know, we have various different people that we contribute to it. But I'm not really sure who wrote it, and that's still an argument for debate as far as I'm concerned. Also, the stories of creation have been, some will say, which I tend to believe, were written over a much older text, a Babylonian text, a Sumer text, and it was written over top of that story, and it was added, the way I understand, they added a moral clause to the story. You can probably see that later on. But I think the writings are meant to inspire us with ideas and thoughts. There's not one particular theme that is permeates. There are various different ideas and themes that run the whole way through the text, so through both the creation stories. We'll just go to there, that part of it. But I think throughout the Bible, there's many different themes that well out. And so, if you want to go, want me to say that the literal words are inspired in the Bible, I think that's probably a little bit of a stretch for me, and that they're literally true, I think that would be a little bit of a stretch for me also. But I believe what is inspired is what the ideas that are fermenting out of the literal words. I think there's where the inspiration lies. It's like a wine, words are like a wine that is fermenting, and the essence of the wine is what we want. We want to taste the essence of the wine. And I think this is what we want in the words of the Bible, and especially in the creation story. They are rich with an essence that of many different kinds. And there's where we want to drink. Is Eden a physical place, or was it a physical place? Was it in the Middle East? Where was it? Is it supposed to be a picture of an understanding of a non-physical place in order to explain the way life really was? Generally, the idea that Eden is in the Middle East area is an idea that permeates a lot of theological thought. I'm not sure that the place is modeled after, I think it was modeled after a heavenly place, but whether or not it was actually a place on this earth, I'm not sure. Could it be all the earth? This is an idea that I want to eventually get to through this messages. If it was life was created and permeated from the Middle East, then science tells us that human life through the DNA journeys back to Africa. So how do you include that into the story? It creates paradoxes and issues that I think the text is trying to illustrate a more spiritual understanding of things rather than a physical reality. A picture I've always gotten from the creation stories, there's a lot going on. There's not just one single thing going on. There's a lot going on. The text is very, very rich, and every word means something. And you can't leave one thing out. I have to deal with an English version because I don't know Hebrew or Aramaic, so I have to deal with an English version, and that's what I deal with. And so I always seen God as the many. I'm going to use that term I'm going to claim that one. God the many. Rather than saying gods and all this kind of stuff, I'm going to simply say, refer to God the many, because I think there was a lot of things going on, and there was a lot of beings doing, a lot of what we would call gods doing many different things. There wasn't just one individual doing all of the work. I don't get that picture at all.
I was wondering in the previous hour what English pronoun we would use for God, because English has he, she, and it. And God doesn't strike me as it, but he and she are both gender specific. So English doesn't have a good pronoun, right?
Right, it doesn't. I have suggested once in a previous message of the holy it.
And I kind of, we could say they, since the Spirit is very inclusive.
The holy they, the holy many. I mean, you could go a lot of different. The holy we, the royal we.
That's good.
Yeah, that That was a part of what that was trying to predict, illustrate was the Holy We. It was God as a Holy We. So it definitely is not a single being. I think we can probably have a consensus here in this church, anyway, that it's a busy place. There was a lot of things going on. I have a really big problem with narrowing it down to one. And one, as I have said many times, is both infinite and singular. So I can see where the one of the Holy One is an infinite thing or an idea, lack of a better word, thing. It's not that I don't think that Jesus, as a single being who came to this earth and who was part of God, and that Jesus was very important in this whole picture of things amongst the many, for sure. I think he has been, the story says he is elevated above all the others. Eventually, he's going to take power. But even Jesus had a host of angels that he could call upon. He could call upon the many at any time he wanted to. And so there was a many around us. He looked up to the Father. He looked up beyond himself. He was not alone on this earth, and neither are we. That's the one point that I want. We are not alone. And an illustration that I'm going to use, an analogy, is like when we go into a hospital. We may be a little ill, or we're going in there to get something done. There's all kinds of professionals running around there trying to help us. And each one has their own specialty. So you can see that, use that as an illustration as to how I see the garden or this earth. It's busy. They're all, and in my illustration of the hospital, they're all doing all kinds of different jobs, trying to make us well again to put us back into the world or the garden again. So that's how I want to see it. Whoever compiled these idea or these texts, and I'm sure there's some here that could probably give an understanding better than me of the story of who wrote it and who compiled it. I think many people did over the years. It wants to move ideas. It doesn't need to be history nor science for it to be important. Just because it was written over a Babylonian text does not mean that it doesn't have no meaning, that it has no relevance. It still does. It still has relevance, very much. So let's look at the text. First of all, it says the Lord God, or the God of many, planted a garden. So there was a garden that was planted, that was already planted and existed. And it was in the east. And the east is always, in mythology, and is considered to be a beginning. It means it rises in the east, it sets in the west, north is heaven, south is hellbound. So these are the directions. So when something is built in the east, or the garden is in the east, it's a beginning of something. So it's telling us in the beginning of something, beginning of this earth, is Eden. Eden is a place of splendor, of plentiness, of tranquility, utopia, what have you. You're going to put a whole kind of different words along with the word Garden of Eden or Eden. So it was a place in which we were put into, which man was put into, humanity, which in my understanding is the earth. I'm going to say heaven was the earth because I think there exists in this whole universe and universes and beyond a greatness that we fail to understand. And the earth is a little garden in the middle of everything. So I'm going to see it as an earth. The earth is the garden. And man was formed and placed there. And formed meaning he was placed there, he had limitations. We were formed from the clay, as I said last week, of the earth, and we had many limitations. We have many limitations. Our body has many limitations. Formed, in my world, means limitations. And then he put this person, the story is trying to tell us, that humanity started in this place, which I call earth, this garden. And God made to grow all kinds of trees out of the ground. So are we to mean and to understand that God placed man in a forest? Is that what the story is telling us? What do trees mean? Different places, different people.
Races.
Different races, different people. I've always said that trees are like a paradigm of thought. But I'm in a physical sense, I'm going to say that a forest has great potential. No matter where, so we were placed in a garden on this earth with great potential. If you are, a forest has like lumber, it has birds and animals, even though the story goes on to say it's created, the animals are created afterwards. But a forest has great potential. It has bushes, raspberry bushes, you know. So the story, the way I see it is, in the physical sense, until we move to the spiritual sense here real soon, is a place of great potential. And no one can deny that this earth has great potential. We are placed in a realm and a reality, a physical world, which has great potential. Later choice will come, as I will later on. I'm only going this far. The trees, he says, were pleasing to the eye and good for food. Up until this point, you could say it's a physical reality. The minute you put the word eye in there, one eye, that means that's a spiritual dimension. Eyes are, when it refers to eyes in the Bible, it's your physical eyes. And when it says eye, it means your spiritual eye, the single eye. That's your spiritual eye. So for me, right here, it enters into, with the, that one word, moves the whole story to a spiritual dimension.
Where was she reading eye about?
Right here in the text. It was pleasing to the eye. Meaning this eye, this eye. Eyes are meant, when it refers to it in the Bible, eyes, plural, mean your physical eyes. Most generally, all the time. Eye refers to singular, one eye. Which you know, of all people, know that that means your spiritual eye, yes. So immediately, as I read this text, now I don't know Hebrew, and I don't know how, I only have the English version to deal with. And so I'd have to refer to Shane if he wants to change the idea. But for me, all the texts that I've ever read say I, right here. And so that adds a spiritual dimension to the whole story. And from now on, you have the choice of either one, or both are depicted. Yes, Jean.
Some translations say pleasant to the sight. King James says pleasant to the sight. Chapter 2, verse 9.
Well, it depends on the translation. It depends on the idea that the writer wants to portray in the idea. The compiler, again, gets to decide what he wants to put into, or he or she wants to put into the writing. And that has happened many, 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 many times in the Bible.
Revised Standard says that too.
Well, I have a very modern and liberal writing of the NIV, and it says I. So what does the Pew Bible say? Anybody, I see somebody has it out. Sight? Okay, it's open for debate. What do you think? And good for food. Okay, well, what do you think? It depends on who wrote it. Exactly.
Modern language does say I. And good for
yes.
They both go over there.
Yeah, that's a good point. So even though it says sight,
they mix together.
And
beauty is for the soul and mind.
So it's all beauty. Intertwined.
Yes, your mind is more in harmony.
An army?
Harmony.
Harmony, yes. Yes, there's a harmonic essence that comes out of both sides. So it moves from both sides. The tree of knowledge of good and evil, the twisted around together. which we'll eventually get to. Not now, but later. So, from this point on, you can go either way. It's good for food. The story, in the middle of the garden, there is a tree of life and a tree of knowledge of good and evil. The tree of conscience.
Knowledge of good and evil. He planted the tree of life and also the tree of conscience, giving knowledge of good and evil.
That's interesting.
It's interesting to have all these translations.
I don't know how you would get the tree of life and move it to the tree of conscience.
Well, if no.
Meaning that you should know the difference between right and wrong. Well, your conscience, meaning your inner voice, not conscious, meaning that you're alive.
No, consciousness is being, you know, your cognitive.
Yeah.
You know, see things without that. There is no
one. Yes. More than one tree.
But it, was it conscious or conscience?
Conscience. Knowledge of good and evil.
Cognitive thought. Is that what it's trying to say?
Conscience.
Conscience.
Not really cognitive. Modern language is from the ground the Lord God caused to sprout every tree that is pleasing to the eye and good for food, the tree of life, too, in the center of the garden, and the tree of knowing good and evil. It's complicated, isn't it?
Yes, it is. That's the point that I want to make today. The text is very, very complicated. It's not a simple, easy read as we have been led to believe.
And I need to know.
No.
How can we know where East of Eden is then?
Well, next Sunday I was going to get into that a little bit more.
East of Eden?
Do you have an idea?
I don't know where I'm getting it from, but I thought the Bible said that it was near the Tigris and Euphrates where they come together and the third river comes across. It's actually in lower Iraq. I looked it up. My brother was stationed over in Iraq.
Atmosphere means Eden means atmosphere, she said, in the Jewish thought.
Yeah.
When you get into Jewish thought, there's a variety of things. It is so rich. There's no one single thought. So, it's very rich. The way I understand is we know where the Tigris and Euphrates is. That's two of the rivers, but the other two we don't know for sure.
And that's why we can't pinpoint.
That's why we can't pinpoint.
With potential, rich potential.
What I went out last night and looked up off up to the star, and the Milky Way runs across the sky. It's a river. Now that's where I'm going to go next Sunday.
And did you see the moon?
Did I see the moon?
Yeah, 2 weeks ago I didn't know. See it. The sky was so clear. All I could see was the moon, and it was a perfect half.
Oh.
Did you see it?
So the Milky Way is a river that runs through the sky, and this river that runs through Eden, which I think is illustrating a river that runs through Eden, and from there it goes out to four headwaters. So it comes from someplace through Eden and continues on. That's the picture I get. And that's where I'm going to go next Sunday, because I didn't have I didn't figure I had enough time today to get to it. I don't want to make everybody think too hard. So remember little bits at a time.
Thank you.
Never mind. You're very smart, so I was being kind of facetious, whatever. So I've always seen trees as paradigms of thought. So in the garden, whether you think it as a physical place, which I don't necessarily do, I think it's portraying a spiritual idea. that there was given to us, or it illustrates to us, the potential or the reality of that there are many different paradigms of thought and many types of existence and not only in this reality, but the other realities that are next, you know, our next life or the one that we came from, or however you want to believe that. So I always see trees as that. Paradigms of thought, non-physical thought systems, worlds within worlds. And I think that is how I see this text, worlds within worlds. And the earth was made one world within a world, many different cultures. In this earth, we have many different worlds within this world. We have many different cultures, worlds within worlds. We have ethnicities, worlds within worlds. And we have individuals, living beings like us. We are worlds within worlds. So this is what I want us to take. Another thing that I want us to take, that we are worlds within worlds within worlds within worlds. And it goes on in infinity. And we are part of that. And the story here places us in the middle, whatever that means. That means we are surrounded around us with a lot of life. And it is a very busy place. Our reality in this earth, in this reality, is very busy. I see some people thinking. Anybody want to share before I close? No. I understand what you're saying, but is this physical reality a safe place?
No, Western thought and Eastern thought.
Yes, you do. White European influence, Christian influence, has done a lot to destroy a lot of thought. And if you don't face that reality, then you're not going to get anywhere. Because, I'm sorry, white Christian European faith, evangelicals are carrying it on today, are doing a lot to kill a lot of what I call ideas and spirit that exists in the Bible. And why they are doing that, I have no idea. I can't give a reason why they would want to do something like that. But white Europeans have done a lot to kill.
And worlds within worlds could be all the different species, you know, like animal life, trees, sea life, and there are worlds within worlds, and you live in
yes.
All that.
She is saying nature has a world within a world within a world. And we have,
with
each one, yes.
World, so, you know,
So my world has to be in tune with your world, which has to be in tune with nature, which has to be in tune, which, but for some reason, white European thought, Christian thought, has destroyed that idea. Out of oneness, of that there's one God, and that's it. And I think that's not biblical at all, myself. Not biblical at all, but yet it's been done. It still is today. And I can't give you an answer why.
That, say after.
Okay, my argument on that one is that's the Ten Commandments, and that was Yahweh, the God of Israel, given that to exclusively to the Israelite people, because he was a jealous, vengeful God, and he didn't want nothing else before him.
Well, what about Allah?
Who?
Allah.
They have made their God jealous also, yes. I'm not saying there's other gods that are not jealous. But see, Jesus came in and said, okay, I'm going to rise above all that. Love your neighbor as yourself. That's a total foreign idea. So even though you have these gods or many, you're supposed to love one another and appreciate the many and love your neighbor as yourself. It's not exclusive of all of this and have something else altogether. It's Jesus built on top of all of that. Yeah, he points up to the Father. He points on a continuation up. Yeah. John writes it, which is a more liberal writing, for sure. And but it's yes, he points up further. We are in the middle of something. Middle. Here we are, middle again. There is something before us, and there's going to be something after us. We are in this middle. That's another picture. In the middle of the garden. We are in the middle. There's stuff all around us.
I think the most encouraging thing you said, this is my perspective, so watch out, is that this was written on top of the Babylonian text.
That it was on top of the Babylonian text? Yes.
That humans have been trying to figure out, or whatever is out there, whatever species, have been trying to figure out the answer very basic questions like where did we come from and why are we here? And I think the white European perspective of saying we have the answer is out to lunch, because I think as time has gone on and we have become more knowledgeable in our center position of what's out there, we have different answers. And I don't think the answers are going to stop. And I think when we decided to end Bible and not add to it, I think that's just another idea of we have first.
Yes. The Bible in no way says there's nothing before it. It was built upon something. And it continues on. Revelation continues on too. We are in the middle again.
So in the context of what kind of said our mom is being upset, concerned, and whatever about being challenged by these other entities, I find it very secure that this concept is going on all this time. And we don't know what time reference we ought to use.
What is time?
You know, but it's been for a considerable length of space and time as we understand it.
If we think we're the only ones, this generation is the only ones that's wrestling with this idea, we're not. Humans have been wrestling with these ideas, like you said, ever since. And we're no further, I shouldn't say we're no further to the, we have expanded our idea of what is there much more.
So we can ask more questions.
Yeah, so we have more questions. I've always said if I get an answer to one question, I have 10 more automatically. And that's, you're lucky to get an answer to one question. And, you know, even that is debatable, whether or not you get a correct answer. And so it's all fluid. And that's something, we want concrete stuff. And I think that was an effort of what white Christianity has done, tried to do, was this is concrete. This is the way it is. This is absolute. But in doing so, they killed a lot of spirit movement that should have happened along the way and should go back to happen. Yes.
Well,
And humans have been this way ever since.
Some.
Yeah, we've had this variety ever since, I think. I think now we're like trying to segment each other, like we don't want to see you, we don't want to see you, we want to be in islands under ourselves, and I think that's a difficult place. That's totally not biblical at all. There was something else I wanted to, ethics and morals. Christianity has a tendency to say this is right and that is wrong. To Kill a Mockingbird, most of us know the movie. I can't remember all the names of the characters, but the lawyer said, tried to raise his children, Scout and all them, morally right, but in the end, the person who killed somebody, you know, was a challenged person, and to prosecute him was, they had to lie to cover the whole thing up. So what is right and what is wrong is very complicated. That's one of the things I take from To Kill a Mockingbird. One of the many things is, it's very complicated. If you want to have a systematic way of what is right and what is wrong, then you should have prosecuted the person with special needs. And
but you have to carry compassion in there too.
Well,
you have to. If we looked at everything as black and white, how many of us might be in jail right now?
I mean, just because we didn't get caught? Yeah, color your skin too. Yes, yes. And what was his name? Bill? Tom? What was he, the black dude that was prosecuted? Tom.
Atticus.
He, because of his skin, realized that there was probably no chance for him, and he went running out, and they shot him. And that movie has a lot of issues to dealing with, race and a lot of problems that we have facing the world today. I just don't see in our reality that morals are cut and dry. This is the one last point I want to make. The Ten Commandments was cut in stone, and there was no give or no spirit to it. Jesus took them and made them alive and said, love the Lord thy God with all your heart. Love what you understand and what you believe. And if you can turn to your neighbor and love him or her as yourself out of this whole system that you believe and love the Lord, then you're doing, it's more of a fluid, more of a passionate or a compassionate way of applying the laws or morality in the world. But if you're going to stick to the Ten Commandments, a stone that's cut in stone, hard rock, then good luck. Moses broke them, and there was another copy written. That's another whole. So was the Ten Commandments written by a man, Moses, or were they really given to you by God? Moses smashed the ones given to him by God. Jerry.
But if you look through history, there has been many occasions where a cultural change or revolution has changed the structure of morality, such as during the Nazi regime, morals shifted to where it allowed them to kill so many people, and it was considered okay.
Because under the tree or the knowledge of good and evil that which Hitler used, he made it okay to do that. Out of a single idea, he said, okay, it's okay to kill the Jews or anybody.
Right.
But that morality, I get your point, but he made it moral. He did. Oh, yeah.
They went in and blew it. But if you take even during the Spanish insurrection and look at what they did, I mean, they changed the morals. So it's been throughout.
You're absolutely right.
It is not just Christianity.
No, I agree with you. I was only pointing out European thought. Yes, out of an idea that wants to rule over top of every other idea, every other paradigm of thought, we have killed many people. Yes, and still do it, right to this very day. It's happening right to this very day. I think that's a difference between a stone cold Ten Commandments look and a Jesus look, is why we do that. They make a morality out of stone, like Hitler did, or various different groups. They say, this is right, this is wrong, we have the right to go out here and kill you in the name of what we understand. And they shape morality out of a stone cold logic, or so said logic. We are not alone. I'm going to conclude, unless anybody else. We are not alone. There is a will in the world. I think there is a will or a plan, we want to say, of some sort. Right now, there's a lot of interplay. We are cared for. And the eye of the many is upon us. And Jesus came to lift up all of humanity. And we are loved.
Gave me meaning, and you there's no